Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. Before we begin, I just want to note that Judge Sparks will be participating on the record. First case this morning is United States versus Leibert. Captain Castanian, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Lee, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Samantha Castanian, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, represent the appellant, Technical Sergeant Matthew Leibert, in today's case. Chief Judge Olson, I'd like to respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Trial counsel committed prosecutorial misconduct by using the substance of Sergeant Leibert's guilty plea without his consent to produce a wrongful conviction. If, however, this court finds that defense counsel invited trial counsel's actions, then defense counsel were ineffective for offering Sergeant Leibert's guilty plea when there was no objectively reasonable strategic or tactical purpose for doing so. Both of these errors are of a constitutional dimension, and both errors lead to relief for Sergeant Leibert, such that the litigated findings and sentence must be set aside. Turning to prosecutorial misconduct, the government cannot meet its burden of proving harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt because of how weak the government's case was. As the dissent at the Air Force Court properly noted, the government's case rested entirely on Lee's testimony, and therefore—
Counsel, what do we do with the principle that we have to presume that the military judge knew the law and, in fact, followed it? In a situation like this where it's a judge-alone trial, how does that affect our analysis when it comes to prejudice?
When it comes to prejudice, it doesn't, Your Honor, according to United States versus Huckel, where this court unequivocally stated that the presumption the military judge correctly followed the law would normally result in no legal error, so the first part. Not that the acknowledged error is harmless. The presumption cannot somehow rectify the error or render it harmless. Even if this court did not follow those words exactly and applied the presumption to the prejudice analysis, there are indications in the record that the military judge did not know and follow the law in this case. It also goes to the fact that Sergeant Leibert does not have the burden on the prejudice analysis. The government does.
Counsel, before we get to the second part of your argument, I think the Chief Judge's logical point is that if the military judge said, that's an improper argument, I'm not going to listen to it, then there wouldn't be any prejudice if the military judge didn't pay any attention to that argument. And so it wouldn't be the case that there was an error and there was prejudice. I mean, isn't that the correct logic, that if the military judge said, that's an invalid argument, I'm not paying attention to it, then we wouldn't be in harmless error analysis. We would just simply say we presume the judge didn't commit an error there. Well, we'd say there was an error, but we'd say it was harmless, right?
Your Honor, that is an option. However, when comparing Sergeant Leibert's case to other cases with Hill's errors, when military judges, especially in a case like Huckel, in fact, where the military judge asserted that
They were getting to a different question, which is, should we apply the presumption in this case? But if we don't see a reason not to apply the presumption, isn't it just logically the case that if the military judge ignored the improper, if we assume that the trial counsel statement was improper, but we also presume that the military judge ignored that statement, then how can there be prejudice?
Because of the burden. Ultimately, Your Honor, this court cannot be certain that the error did not affect the proceedings. And when that is the case, because it has to be that there's no reasonable possibility, which is a very high burden in this case, and compared to other cases that have constitutional errors, like Guardado, Hills, Prasad, all of them, most if not all of them, relied solely on just testimony from the named victim. And Sergeant Leibert's case is very similar. So even
But let's suppose the military judge said, trial counsel, the things you've just said are not in evidence before the court in this proceeding. I am not going to pay attention to any of them. They're going to have no effect on my ruling. Would you still say that it couldn't be harmless? I mean, he didn't say that. He said nothing. But if he had said, I'm going to totally ignore this, that you're wrong, this is improper, would there still be prejudice? I mean, it would still be an error that the trial counsel said it, but the military judge says, I'm not going to listen to it.
I think it's much less likely that there would be prejudice in a case where the military judge stated on the record, this is an improper argument, I'm not going to consider it. We don't have that in this case.
No, but don't we have the presumption, which is equivalent to that?
Not necessarily in this case, Your Honor.
Well, if we had the presumption, before we get to the question of whether we should give the presumption, if we have the presumption, wouldn't it be the equivalent?
No, Your Honor. Because with that presumption, if there are indications on the record that the military judge did not know and follow the law, then that presumption doesn't apply. So
can you point to us instances on the record where there is, in fact, an indication that the military judge did not know the law?
Yes, Your Honor. Starting at the very beginning with the colloquy that the military judge engaged with defense counsel, there was no follow-up with Sergeant Leipert saying, are you waiving, or do you consent to the waiver of your right against compulsory self-incrimination for the use of your guilty plea? That's the first indicator. That also goes to the idea that...
Why would he have asked that question at that point in the proceedings?
I agree with you, Your Honor. It's not clear what being aware of the guilty plea meant at that time. But if it had been offering the substance of the guilty plea, that would have been the next question, and the colloquy should have occurred per Kaiser, Hansen, and RCM 913A. But it didn't. So that's one indicator that the substance of the guilty plea, at least in the mind of the military judge, wasn't being used at that time. But then we can look into all the other indicators here to continue answering your question, Your Honor, that the military judge was very involved in this case. So when looking at start with the closing. Right before, in the middle of trial counsel's closing,
Captain, let's not get to the closing. Defense counsel introduced that evidence as impeachment during cross-examination. So it based upon your analysis that the military judge did not properly know the law, so therefore the presumption should be rebutted. What is your position that what the military judge should have done at the time defense counsel introduced the police reports which substantiated the underlying behavior of the other charges?
It did substantiate her claims, Your Honor, but they were all about prior inconsistent or prior consistent statements. The only way that...
I'm sorry, could you just make sure that the microphone is pulled a little closer to you?
Yes, Your Honor. Those were not entered substantively in the same way that Sergeant Leipert's guilty plea was entered. So the only way that what trial counsel is able to argue is that Casey was, quote, undeniably telling the truth is because Sergeant Leipert corroborated her alone.
But the underlying facts, she testified to the underlying facts because the underlying facts were all contained in both the police reports and in the video recording. So I see you're trying to draw a distinction. I'm not seeing that distinction. The substance came in. The content came in.
The substance came in, Your Honor, but not the credibility analysis. It's still her credibility that's under question with prior consistent and inconsistent statements. This court can look to United States versus Williams, which provides an excellent example of how what is needed under the government's burden to prove harmlessness for a set of three different victims. For one victim, there was corroborating evidence. There was physical evidence of damage to the property, physical injury to the named victim, and outcry witnesses. For that victim, there was no prejudice because the evidence was overwhelming.
Counsel, is it your position that the defense was entitled to use the guilty pleas support the credibility of appellant, but the prosecution was forbidden from using the same facts to support the credibility of the victim?
No, Your Honor. The defense could have used Sergeant Leipert's guilty plea in that manner had they followed essentially the requirements to do so, that Sergeant Leipert was aware of the right that he was waiving when that guilty plea was being used.
But again, when he was when that all happened, what, 90 minutes, two hours earlier, nobody knew the defense's strategy at that point.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because what happens in that initial conversation, defense counsel makes it very clear that they're stating, I wasn't necessarily alerting you, the fact finder, to the guilty plea itself. He was road mapping his cross-examination of Key, which goes back to answering Your Honor's question about what was happening was all about impeachment, not corroborating or using Sergeant Leipert's prior statements or credibility to bolster himself, or it was simply, we are going to impeach in this manner using the statements that were brought in, but that does not change or bring in the guilty plea. And if it did, that's ineffective assistance of counsel, because there was no objectively reasonable purpose for bringing in the guilty plea on a case that immediately corroborated. And going back to Williams for one moment, Your Honor, with your prior question, the other two named victims had no corroborating evidence, but they did have prior consistent statements and inconsistent statements.
Is it, I mean, you're saying it was really about the evidence and not the plea itself, but I mean, what the defense counsel said was, I think in a mixed plea in front of a panel, the type fact finder, sometimes we would have the opportunity of certainly disclosing to the members the existence of the plea. It's, I mean, they're talking specifically about the plea, not the statements. I mean, they wanted the fact finder to be aware of the guilty plea, right? So isn't this really about the guilty plea and whether or not that was fairly in front of the military judge or not?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And the point here is that whatever defense counsel invited with that initial conversation, it wasn't what trial counsel did later.
So what could trial counsel have done? Like, I know you think they went over the line. How could they have used the existence, if the existence of the guilty plea was fairly in front of the military judge, how could they have used it? What did they do that went over the line?
All of the cases that we have, like United States versus Reich, Flores, Rivera, contemplate that it's almost never an appropriate strategy. But in the event Rivera provides guidance on what could have happened, if they're using it to bolster Sergeant Leipert's credibility, which did not happen, and the only time it did happen in Sergeant Leipert's case is on defense counsel's closing and essentially a rebuttal to trial counsel's misuse in the first place.
But counsel, that, you know, that doesn't really answer my brethren's question, because your answer essentially is, yeah, that was their strategy and it backfired. But his question was, is there an instance wherein if the plea could have come in, could the trial counsel have used it? That was his question.
Yes, Your Honor. It's okay. Ultimately, that did not happen in this case. So if there had been the colloquy with Sergeant Leipert where he understands and knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently waives his right against compulsory self-incrimination and that guilty plea comes in, then trial counsel could have used it in the way that they did in this case.
So do you think at that point in the proceedings he would have just needed to stop and said, all right, well, before we're going to do that, I need to talk to the appellant again?
Yes, Your Honor, and that goes back to Chief Judge Olson's question about what are these examples in the record that show that the military judge did not know and follow the law. And his silence in the closing argument is one example, when just immediately before he's engaging trial counsel during closing argument on misuse of the law on a slide. And that was what I was talking about when it comes to trial counsel's use of or engagement with the military judge in closing argument, aside from the issue here. The military
is that what happens, this going back to the plea colloquy and the military judge talking to the accused, is that what happens? There's an established process for doing this in front of a panel. Is that what happens in that process? I know that's not the case we have here, but is that in those cases, is that what happens? Do they go back into essentially redo the plea colloquy to make sure that the accused is on board with this strategy?
Your Honor, at least United States versus Reisch contemplates that, that and Kaiser, that if this is going to happen, there needs to be a colloquy on with the accused on the record. RCM 913A's discussion section says the same thing. It's an inquiry with the accused on the record. If they're going to use it, there needs to be a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver. And there's another quote from Hansen that's helpful here, where bedrock constitutional rights are at issue and are waived. We should not settle for inference and presumption when certainty is so readily obtained. It would have taken minutes, less than minutes, for the military judge to engage and clarify what does, quote, being aware of the guilty plea mean. But he did not do that, and that goes to the fact that the military judge did not know and follow the law in this case.
Counsel, on that specific point, what are we actually to make of this introductory discussion that they had? I mean, it was sort of the nature of the defense counsel making an opening statement and the military judge interrupting the defense counsel. But did the military judge ever say that the guilty plea or anything was admitted? I mean, it was kind of just a discussion. Are we considering this? But wouldn't there have to be something more formal to suggest that that was admitted into the evidence? In fact, part of the argument that the trial counsel's statement was incorrect was none of that stuff was ever admitted. Are we to interpret what happened there as the military judge actually saying, okay, it's now in evidence before me, or is it just, okay, that's what you're promising to introduce, but it never happened, that he never introduced it? Trial defense counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. So, first and foremost, I agree with the premise that it wasn't entered into evidence, and then trial counsel took something that was not in evidence and used it to bolster the named victim's credibility. That is prosecutorial misconduct, and that is why this court can't be certain that the findings were not tainted by that error. Alternatively, the United States versus Carter, which is cited in United States versus Lewis in the government's brief, so it's not cited in one of the briefs, but it's an example of prosecutorial misconduct where defense counsel had promised to bring in evidence and or call a witness specifically, and then they did not. And then trial counsel went forward and said, this evidence is uncontroverted, uncontroverted, and that was error. And that's an example, again, of defense counsel might have promised something, but it was still ultimately error for trial counsel to comment on the accused's right to silence. It's the same principle here, except for the fact we're talking about the right against self-incrimination. And ultimately, defense counsel, and Your Honor, I apologize, you see that my time has expired. May I finish?
Please wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ultimately, defense counsel did not offer that substance. Trial counsel took it and misused it later on, and that's why this court can't be certain ultimately.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Lee.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Kate Lee, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States.
Captain Lee, I don't want to interrupt you, but could you pull the microphone a little closer?
Yes, Your Honor. In trial, both the prosecution and defense play the cards that they are dealt. So with that in mind, this court should affirm appellant's convictions and sentence for two reasons. First, trial defense counsel were not ineffective by alerting the fact finder to appellant's mixed pleas because it was consistent with their most viable strategy. And second, trial counsel's comments during closing were a fair response to that strategy and therefore not error. And even if it was error, it was invited by the defense and therefore not a basis for relief. As to my first point, Your Honor, again, trial defense counsel can only play the cards that they are dealt. And by alerting the military judge to appellant's guilty plea, it was a reasonable way to make the best out of a bad hand. And this court should not allow the distorting effects of hindsight to color its view of what happened in this case. The defense chose their most viable strategy. By entering mixed pleas, they kept out a lot of very damaging recordings that would have come in otherwise. And by doing so, during the litigated findings case, they were able to present appellant as someone who was taking responsibility for only that which he had done and not taking responsibility for that which he did not think he was guilty of. And so by leveraging appellant's guilty plea, and it was the fact of the guilty plea, not the substance of the guilty plea whatsoever, They put themselves in a position where the fact finder, of course, cannot draw adverse inferences from appellant's silence.
Counsel, what is your response to the appellant counsel's argument that it was never the fact of the guilty plea was never actually admitted into evidence, that it wasn't actually something that was before the court or the court could have or should have considered, and that then therefore the trial counsel obviously erred by mentioning it?
Well, Your Honor, the fact of the guilty plea was on the record during the colloquy that the military judge had with trial defense counsel right at the end of his opening statement. He confirms, I'm operating in a world where I'm aware of the guilty plea. And trial defense counsel said yes. So although they're not going to introduce a care inquiry into evidence, it's essentially like the trial defense counsel asking the military judge, the fact finder, to take judicial notice the way he would if it was in front of members. He would just tell the members at an earlier session, the appellant pled guilty to XYZ things, and that would be it. And that's essentially what happened here. He, of course, did the care inquiry, so he was aware and didn't have to repeat that out loud to himself. But it's almost like he took judicial notice of the fact that appellant just pled guilty, and that was it. And then going...
Counsel, on that point, isn't there something more formal that has to be required, like the military judge expressly says, I'm taking that into account? I mean, it sounded kind of like they were discussing that this might come up. It was an opening statement. Opening statements are not where evidence is introduced. I mean, it just seems like it was general discussion at the start of the trial, but we never had a formal statement by the military judge that that guilty plea or anything that was said in the colloquy was coming into evidence on the disputed charges. But you're saying that this is enough. Why is that enough?
Your Honor, it's enough because there are three things that tell us that a more formal inquiry isn't required. The RCM, United States versus Rivera, and the lack of a bench book colloquy. So the RCM does not contain an express requirement that the military judge engage with appellant on the record about this matter. By contrast, there are other RCMs that require the military judge to inquire personally with the accused, you know, if whether or not it's the choice of forum was his, who he wants to be represented by, etc. And United States Rivera also contemplates that either appellant or his counsel could ask that his mixed pleas be put in front of the fact finder.
But counsel, even if we put all that aside, did the military judge actually take the guilty pleas, agree that the guilty plea would be taken into account? I mean, for example, if they had said, we want you to take judicial notice that January 24th is a Wednesday, the military judge says, I take judicial notice that January 24th is a Wednesday, that there's some kind of statement. This was a question that arose during an opening statement, and I just don't see any specific statement by the military judge saying, defense counsel has asked me to take this guilty plea into account, and I'm going to take it into account. I mean, it was sort of initial discussion, but, and put aside, did he have to do any further inquiry? Even if he didn't have to do any further inquiry, did the military judge actually take it into account, say that he was going to?
Your Honor, yes. At the very end of that colloquy with trial defense counsel, of course, they're sort of talking over each other, but he says, obviously, I am the judge, but even as a fact finder, I am aware of it. And this was after trial defense counsel confirmed, you know, yes, we'd like you to operate in a world where you're aware of the guilty plea.
Thank you.
And by doing so, you know, and if you look at the trial defense's strategy as a whole, Your Honor, starting with the opening statement, even before that colloquy, he starts by pointing out this police report that he expects to come into evidence. So it's something that they've contemplated, you know, even before they got to trial. Their defense strategy was to leverage appellant's honesty once he pled guilty. And Mr. Conway did the opening statement. A different civilian defense counsel did cross-examination and the closing. And you can see their strategy play out throughout the case. So, of course, trial counsel was on notice of what the defense strategy was. So it's only fair that trial counsel, when they see the cards that the defense has played, responds in the body of their closing argument to this theory that appellant is the one who's taking responsibility and, you know, somehow is the one who's not. And although, you know, appellants suggesting that credibility was the only thing that supported their case, I think this court should look at Prosecution Exhibit 1, which came into evidence during the litigated findings case. I think the corroborative effect of those recordings, in which you can hear appellant's own voice saying, you should never not want it, and I even forced myself on you, and you act like a rape victim.
But counsel, didn't those recordings tie to the events in Australia in 2017, as opposed to what was the contested charges which occurred in 2016 in Missouri? And that recording went in support of a charge that was later dismissed.
Your Honor, the recordings came in as res gestae of one of the other litigated sexual assaults.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it was, it came in as res gestae of a sexual assault that was ultimately, of which appellant was ultimately acquitted. However, those recordings would still have been independently admissible as evidence of appellant's motive, his state of mind, and his modus operandi, because it tells us why he thinks he's allowed to sexually assault, because she should never not want it. And the convicted sexual assaults of which appellant was convicted was supported by testimony that he said similarly vile things, such as, you're my wife, this is my right, and expressing that he's entitled to have sex with her because she's his wife. And then his modus operandi, I forced myself on you. So he's telling us exactly why he thinks he can do the crime and how he did it. And so it's not that it's nothing about what trial counsel said about his credibility that made the difference. It was appellant's own voice that made the difference in this case. It's him telling the fact finder, telling me when he thinks no one else is listening, giving them a glimpse into his criminal state of mind. That's what made the difference. That's what boosted her credibility, not trial counsel's comments by any means. And, Your Honor, going back to the presumption about the military judge, of course the military judge is presumed to know and apply the law, even if he doesn't intervene during the middle of improper argument. And so the fact that the military judge was silent when trial counsel was making these comments does not mean that he improperly considered the guilty plea by any means.
Counsel, what is your response to the appellant's argument that if this is really before if the military judge was sort of accepting, taking judicial notice of the guilty pleas, that he should have stopped, it would have been trivial to do so, and revisited his colloquy with the accused and made sure that he was affirmatively waiving his constitutional rights?
Well, Your Honor, first, when it comes to the argument about how the use of the fact of the guilty plea somehow infringed on his constitutional rights, the government disagrees that it did so.
Let's hear that part. The government disagrees that it did so. Let's hear that part before you get to the second half of your statement.
Yes, Your Honor. So, of course, the right against self-incrimination protects appellant from incriminating himself about the things of which he is not yet guilty. And so the fact that he pled guilty does not somehow incriminate him with respect to the contested offenses. And that's why it's not constitutional error, Your Honor, because appellant never testified. Nobody used any – the prosecutor never reached back into the care inquiry to use anything that appellant said. And instead, the defense was able to use appellant's silence during the litigated findings case as evidence of his innocence, because that's a theory that they were pushing. Instead of having the fact finder, of course the fact finder can't draw adverse inferences from a silence, so the defense asked the fact finder to draw a positive inference instead. So appellant had the unusual, you know, the uncommon advantage of almost denying the allegations without actually testifying, without actually being subject to the crucible of cross-examination. And because of that, in sentencing, if he had actually testified and the fact finder found him guilty nonetheless, the prosecution could have argued that in sentencing as mendacity, as lack of rehabilitative potential. But because he didn't, the defense strategy saved appellant from being subject to that while still effectuating a denial. So it's not that anything that they did caused appellant to incriminate himself. It was almost the opposite, where they're saying his silence and his mixed pleas are proof that he didn't do this thing.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to be clear. Your argument here is that if the trial counsel, defense counsel had never brought up the guilty pleas, and that the trial counsel had still said what they had said, that that wouldn't be improper argument because they were violating his constitutional rights. It would be because they were just arguing facts not in evidence. This is just an evidence. Essentially, that was why their argument would be improper. Not there's no constitutional dimension.
Your Honor, I think if the defense had not brought up the fact of the guilty plea and trial counsel argued exactly as it did, and the defense had presented their case exactly the same otherwise and elicited all the same facts and put in all the same exhibits, trial counsel's argument might be improper vouching, but it wouldn't be constitutional because he's not reaching back into the Kerr inquiry whatsoever. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And this goes to, and one thing that I'd like to address, Your Honor, is if this court decides that trial counsel's comments were error, again, they were invited by the defense and should not form a basis for relief. But if this court finds that it was also constitutional error, I'd like to take a moment to discuss the burden. Of course, under Tovar Chavez.
Before you get there, I just want to make sure I got the last part of my original question. So your response to appellant then is that there'd be no duty of the military judge to stop and go back. Because there's no constitutional aspect and no constitutional concern, there'd of course be then no duty of the military judge to go back once he realizes the guilty pleas may be coming before him. That's just an evidentiary question. It's not a constitutional question.
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that the military judge does not have to go back because the decision to put the fact of mixed pleas before the fact finder is a strategic one, and strategic decisions belong to the attorney, and they're also virtually unchallengeable in cases where we're talking about ineffective assistance. And so, sort of calling back to something I mentioned earlier, the lack of a bench book colloquy, there are four fundamental decisions that belong to an appellant in a criminal case: who he wants to be represented by, the form in which he wants to be tried, whether or not he's pleading guilty of his own accord, and whether or not he wants to testify. And the bench book contains scripted colloquies about each and every one of these things. By contrast, it does not contain a scripted colloquy about whether or not he's consenting to the use, to alerting the fact finder to the mixed pleas. And it's not like the bench book has forgotten that that's a possibility, because in a case for the members, there is a script where the military judge will inform the members that appellant in an earlier session pled guilty to these offenses on the charge sheet. So the absence of a bench book colloquy is proof, I think, that the military judge was not required to go back and discuss it with the appellant because it's a strategic decision. And if the military judge had to get knowing and intelligent approval from the appellant about each and every strategic decision that his counsel were making, the interruptions to trial would be protracted, and you know, the orderly administration of trial, it would be very difficult if every decision that trial counsel was making had to have knowing and intelligent waiver. So, Your Honor, going back to the burden, if this court finds that it was constitutional error, under Tovar Chavez, of course, the burden currently rests with the government to prove that there is no reasonable possibility that it contributed to the conviction. However, in light of Greer, the Supreme Court case where they unequivocally said that forfeited constitutional error, the burden rests with the appellant, this court should overturn Tovar Chavez because Greer has since then become an intervening event. And in light of Greer, where the Supreme Court is expressly holding that the burden of proving that forfeited constitutional error is prejudicial rests with the appellant, Tovar Chavez is no longer workable in light of that case. However, even if the burden remains with the government, again, appellant's claim fails because there is no reasonable possibility that trial counsel's comments, which formed a negligible part of his argument, 5% of his main closing argument and 3% of his rebuttal argument, they were a negligible part of his argument, and more importantly, his case, those comments, again, as I mentioned, those comments are not what made the difference. It was appellant's own voice in Prosecution Exhibit 1. Barring any further questions, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Lee.
Your Honor, this court should affirm appellant's conviction and sentence because leveraging the fact that appellant pled guilty was a reasonable strategic decision, and fair response to such a defense theory is not improper argument.
Kevin Castanian, you reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make three brief points. First, the error in this case is clearly constitutional. Second, the government's argument relies entirely on Rivera, which is outdated and superseded by other cases. And third, his testimony is the only evidence in this case.
Just pull the microphone a little closer to you, please.
First, this error is clearly constitutional because it is obviously predicated on Sergeant Leipert's guilty plea. When trial counsel stated, excuse me, you are operating a world where he is admitted to crimes against, the government believes you can use that in assessing her credibility on the stand, whether she is telling the truth for the 120 offenses. So you know she is telling the truth. The only way that that can be used is substantive use of the guilty plea. That Sergeant Leipert said X, KC said X, they marry up, she is telling the truth, undeniable. And those are the words the trial counsel uses. It is undeniable that he said these things and she said these things. She's corroborated. She is telling the truth. That is an error of a constitutional dimension because it infringes on the use of Sergeant Leipert's guilty plea, and he has the right against compulsory self-incrimination. Second, Rivera is what the government relies on because it only has dicta that says this is possibly a viable theory. But in this case, it is absolutely not a viable theory for defense counsel to have offered Sergeant Leipert's guilty plea when again.
Why is there a bench book instruction for, if this is not a viable strategy at all, then why is there a bench book instruction that seems to expressly authorize it, at least in front of a panel?
Your Honor, there is a bench book instruction because it requires the accused waiver of it. Ultimately, there has to be some sort of colloquy on the record with the accused about the waiver of rights. And that comes from both Hansen, Kaiser, and RCM 913A's discussion section, where it has to be from the accused. This is making sure that this court or any appellate review court has no concern about a silent record for waiver of constitutional rights. That's why there's a bench book.
But counsel, I think the question was not about whether it could be admitted under proper circumstances, about whether this is a proper kind of defense strategy. I mean, your argument was that Rivera is no longer good law, that it's never a proper strategy to bring in the fact that you pleaded guilty to some offenses but not others.
Your Honor, it could be a possible viable strategy, and I acknowledge that that dicta could be used in other cases, but not Sergeant Leipert's case. It was not a viable strategy in Sergeant Leipert's case because of how weak the government's case was, and it rested solely on its credibility.
Okay, but that goes then to ineffective.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
Exactly. And it's really, we're bouncing between these two ideas, and all of the questions that this Court's asked marry up in either what it was originally offered. And if it wasn't the substance of the guilty plea, I recognize my time is up, Your Honor, if I could just briefly conclude with this. It's either the substance of the guilty plea, and that's prosecutorial misconduct, or they offered the substance of the guilty plea wholesale, and that's ineffective assistance of counsel. Either way, Sergeant Leipert deserves relief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until 10:20.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:20.